It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Last year, the Christian Science Monitor reported juvenile incarceration rates in the United States were at their lowest point in 38 years. However, the sentencing of juveniles is still a challenge for the justice system. We're going to explore this issue with Jeff Shook. He is associate professor in the University of Pittsburgh School of Social Work and technical advisor on a play that addresses this topic called Day Room Window. Jeff Shook, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Paul.
Also with us is Bonnie Cohen, writer and director of the play Day Room Window, based on her experiences working in the juvenile justice system. Day Room Window is a new play about nine adolescent girls incarcerated in adult prison. It opens tomorrow night and runs through the 25th at the new Hazlitt Theater. Writer and director Bonnie Cohen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Paul. I'm really glad to be here.
Jeff, the last time you were here, we addressed the Miller decision. Remind our listeners of the issue that this case addresses.
I'd be happy to, Paul. So Miller versus United States came on the heels of two other U.S. Supreme Court decisions in the last decade. The first one, Roper versus Simmons, abolished the death penalty for juveniles. So if you're under the age 18 at the time of your offense, you could not be executed for that offense. The second one, Graham versus Florida, dealt with the question of life without parole sentences for juveniles convicted of non-homicide offenses. And in that case, the court took the rationale from Roper and abolished life without parole for non-homicide offenses. You can't sentence a juvenile to life without parole if they've convicted of non-homicide. So Miller built upon these prior cases and considered the broader issues of the punishment of juveniles, particularly long sentences, life without the opportunity for parole. And it in Miller, the court struck down the use of mandatory sentences. So in Pennsylvania and many other states, 28 states, upon conviction for, say, first-degree murder, second-degree murder in Pennsylvania, or some subset of murder, a life without parole sentence was mandatory. The judge didn't have any discretion. So the court really built upon this rationale that was developed in Roper and Graham, in which young people are different than adults, right? Their culpability is less, and they have this greater opportunity for change, and require decision makers to take a variety of factors into account, including the youthfulness, and really come up with a decision that was a sentence that was crafted to the characteristics of a young person, including the offense, their prior history, and a variety of other characteristics.
What would earn you a life sentence? What would earn a juvenile a life sentence short of homicide?
So in Graham, Terrence Graham was convicted of a series of aggravated home invasions, which he was involved in armed home invasions. He initially got a probation sentence, and then when the judge heard that he was again committing these offenses, and he had violated his probation, he then resentenced him to life without the opportunity for parole. Serious assault of offenses, rape were some of the others that got juveniles very long sentences.
Are fewer juveniles being incarcerated nationwide?
Yes. Over the last decade or so, 15 years, we've seen a pretty substantial increase in the incarceration of juveniles, both in the juvenile system and we believe in the criminal justice system as well, the adult criminal justice system. This follows a period in the late 80s and the 90s where we saw a big increase in the incarceration of juveniles. But there's data that shows that we're down at levels that we haven't been at in several decades.
And why have juvenile incarceration rates dropped?
I would say there's a variety of factors. One is that juvenile crime has dropped. So juvenile violent serious crime, which peaked in the early to mid-1990s, is now down at levels that are lower than we've seen for a number of decades. And overall, juvenile crime has dropped as well. But at the same time, the drop in juvenile incarceration is in response to we really built up. We got tough on crime. We got tough on kids in the 80s and the 90s, and we realized that wasn't working. So states and jurisdictions have been going back to and looking at a lot of research which has built up over that period and saying this is costly, it's not working, and we really need to do something about this, and focusing on other evidence that shows that community-based placements, community-based sanctions can be powerful as well and deter future crime, plus lead to pro-social development.
Is there a racial disparity in the number of juveniles who are incarcerated?
There is a big racial disparity, both in the juvenile justice system as well in the adult criminal justice system. And this disparity occurs across a variety of decision-making points. Some work that I've done, we see differences, racial and geographic differences in who is detained, put into juvenile detention facilities. We see racial and ethnic differences with regard to the amount of time young people serve in facilities. So we see this build up and aggregate over time, but we see substantial differences with regard to race and ethnicity, with regard to who is incarcerated.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guests are Jeff Shook, Associate Professor of Social Work at the University of Pittsburgh. He is a nationally known authority on juvenile justice and an advocate for reforming the sentencing of youth to adult prison. Also with us is Bonnie Cohen, author and director of the play Day Room Window, which deals with juvenile justice issues. And we're going to get into some of the aspects of the play and what inspired it here in just a bit. But again, we welcome your input, your thoughts about the structure of juvenile justice in America. How does it look to you? How has it impacted you and others that you know? 412-246-2002. Is the number to call. Again, 412-246-2002. Our email address, ESSPGH at WESA.FM, and on Twitter at ESSPGH, hashtag EPLive. Jeff Shook, the Supreme Court has turned down petitions regarding the sentencing of juveniles. Do you know why that happened?
Yeah, and actually several were just turned down last week when the court started its new term. So following the Miller decision, one of the questions that the courts had to grapple with was whether Miller was retroactive, and whether basically that means whether it applied to those who had already been sentenced. And so this issue has been making its way up through state courts and into state Supreme Courts. And a number, I think the count is 8 state Supreme Courts have said Miller is retroactive, that it does apply to those who have not exhausted their appeals, but also to those who have exhausted their appeals. So it provides relief to them to challenge their sentence. But 3 to 4 state Supreme Courts have said it is not retroactive, Pennsylvania being one of those. So attorneys have attempted to bring this issue to the state Supreme Court because now it's geography and time basically delineates whether you get relief under Miller. And the state or the U.S. Supreme Court has turned down several appeals from Pennsylvania as well as from other states right now. There's no, you know, people don't know for sure why the court is. Maybe they don't have the votes that some people would want in order to deal with the retroactivity question, or it could be that it's waiting for the issue to come up through the federal system so we can see a split in the circuits, and then the court would be more willing to take on the issue. But for now, whether you get relief is really based on the time that, you know, when you, the date you committed your offense, as well as the jurisdiction, the state.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation, and we have Aaron in downtown Pittsburgh calling. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. So my question relates back to the judge that was convicted about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, for taking bribes for throwing kids in juvie. And I was wondering how much of the juvenile detention system is privatized versus being, run directly by state and local government.
That's a great question. This was an insidious story, and it was, I believe, told in the Michael Moore film, documentary Capitalism, A Love Affair.
And there's a movie about it called Kids for Cash that was in theaters last spring that should be available for other viewing soon. It's a great question, and it depends, right? It varies based on state. It varies based on jurisdiction at times, what is privatized and what's at the state or the county level.
So it's something that's part of the state culture. For example, in Arizona, where it seems that they're turning so much of their justice system, adult and juvenile, over to private contractors, right?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with Arizona. I mean, I'm very familiar with Michigan, where we saw the state system shrink and we saw private providers really become the bulk.
Is that happening in Pennsylvania?
There, No, Pennsylvania has a lot of private providers for sure, but it also has a state system. I don't know what the exact breakdown is in Pennsylvania, but I think there's a mixture here.
Does that tend to happen more at the juvenile level, that we turn this over to, you know, do we pay others to come in and take care of it for us?
I think it does happen more at the juvenile level. And you know, part of it is driven around this issue that there are some providers who can deal with the unique needs of young people. So providers can provide specialized services that really deal with specific needs and can attend to these needs. I think one of the issues that arises is when the private providers sort of drive the system, right? If you have beds and you can fill beds, that's how you're getting paid through the system. So in my experience working across a number of states, I've seen where private providers have dictated policy and practice to a certain degree. So I think there's some positive, but there's also obviously some negative there.
Which leads to what is at the heart of the story of the play, Day Room Window, which has been written by our other guest, Bonnie Cohen, who is here with us in studio. And again, she is author and director of the play Day Room Window, which deals with juvenile justice issues. She has a background working with juveniles who have been sentenced to adult prisons. And first of all, Bonnie, great to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
What compelled you to write this play?
Well, I was I'm a theater professional, and I'm also I trained as a chemical dependency counselor, and I designed some drama therapy techniques to take into juvenile detention. So I worked in juvenile detention for 10 years, and the state of Washington asked me to go into the women's prison to work with 9 incarcerated kids in an adult system. So I went in, and I was pretty naive. I was expecting that I would be able to work with these kids in a very similar way that I worked with kids in the juvenile justice system. And the nature of their incarceration was intolerable to me. And
what was going on?
Well, these kids were locked in a room for 12 hours a day. And they had nothing to do. They had a couple of board games, a radio, a television, and a deck of cards. They never got outside. They didn't leave the room to eat.
They were, and these young women were how old?
15 to 17. And the reason they were confined this way is that they were not allowed by law to have any contact with the adult prisoners. They weren't allowed to even look at them.
So why are they there?
They were sentenced as adults, and that's where they were sent.
Incredible. All right. So you walk in there, and describe your first interaction with them. How are they responding to you?
Well, I walked into the room, and they were screaming and yelling. And
why were they screaming and yelling?
They were very angry that I was going to disturb their day. Meaning they wouldn't get to watch their TV shows. They had developed this this way of living in this room, and it was theirs. And so
it was all they had. Really.
That is all they had. And so this strange woman coming in and trying to teach them anything was abhorrent to them, and they were very angry that I was there. And it took a number of weeks for me to be able to reach them in any way. But the experience was very difficult for me. And
did they test you? Did they kind of put you through their own idea of what a living hell should be for you before they were willing to kind of allow you to gain their trust?
I don't know if that's what motivated them. I do know that I had 10 years of working with kids. So I knew how to try to get to the best part of the kid. And I began to engage them as individuals rather as a group. And by engaging them one-on-one, I was able to discover who they are, what the best things about them were, what their talents were. So that's what I began to work with. And I ended up working with them, just me and them, one-on-one.
And I want to get into some of the interaction that took place and how that eventually led to the idea of creating this play based on your actual experiences. We're talking with Bonnie Cohen. She's author and director of the play Day Room Window. It is opening at the New Hazlitt Theater tomorrow, and it continues through the 25th of October. And also with us is Jeff Shook, who is a associate professor at the Pitt School of Social Work. He is the advisor on this play. It's a fascinating story that parses through all sorts of aspects of how the juvenile justice system works and whether it's really serving the needs of those who are incarcerated in it. It is a play written by Bonnie Cohen and focuses on nine adolescent girls incarcerated in adult prison. It's called Day Room Window, and it opens tomorrow night at the New Hazlitt and runs through the 25th. And with us, writer and director Bonnie Cohen, along with Jeff Shook, who is the technical advisor for the play. He's an associate professor at the University of Pittsburgh School of Social Work and is here to talk about juvenile justice issues and some of what is happening out there that informs the basis of this play. You can join the conversation with our guests at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. And we left off with Bonnie talking about what compelled her to write this play, her experience working with juvenile girls incarcerated as adults, and their reaction to her when she first showed up, which wasn't exactly welcoming. But eventually, you gained their trust, Bonnie, and talk about how things began to turn.
I kept showing up, which was because for these kids, all their lives, there were abandonment issues. People didn't show up. So I kept showing up, and they stopped screaming and yelling at me, and we began to work together. I was doing some drug and alcohol education. I brought in some DVDs on sex and reproduction, and as time went on, I began to work with them as individuals. And as a result of working with them as individuals, I was able to bring them together as a group. And whereas when I first went in, there were huge divisions within the room of certain kids against certain other kids. There was a lot of scapegoating. It was a very bad situation for those kids in that room. But as time went on and I spent time with them in the room, I would bring them things like journals and pens and art projects. And as the weeks went on, they began to accept me that I was the lady who came in on Fridays to spend time with them.
What made you – I mean, I know this is your job, but what kept you determined to keep going there in the face of that abuse, which can be, you know, their verbal abuse of you, which can be very intimidating?
Well, when I first worked in juvenile justice, it took me a year and a half to feel comfortable. I was very uncomfortable working in juvenile justice for about a year and a half.
So doesn't that make you wake up in the morning and go, God, I really don't want to go to work today?
Definitely.
Then how do you keep doing it?
I don't quit things very easily. I just keep going. So, and I felt like, again, if I showed up and I left, I would just be one more person who abandons the kids. And when I was a child, there were adults outside my family who really showed up for me. So once I got to know these kids a little bit, I felt like I needed to continue to show up for them. And so I did. And as time went on, I got to know them as individuals. They became a more cohesive group. And it was actually a very positive experience for me, ultimately.
And in spite of that success, and a lot of times the professionals in this particular field will tell you that if you reach one or maybe two kids, you're batting 1,000.
Yeah, and it also feels like you're throwing out seeds. And you don't know what you're going to say to what kid on what day that might take root and help that kid. So you just go in and you keep throwing out seeds. And that's essentially was my approach.
But you're not going to reach all of them, and there were some that you didn't.
There were some that I did not. There was one really intelligent, energetic, bright kid who really didn't want me there, and she never softened. And then there were some kids that are really sick that that have certain disorders that make you grateful that they're not on the street. So, but in my 10-year experience of working with kids, there were maybe two kids in all that time that I felt that way about. Most of the kids, 95% of the kids that I worked with, were very reachable, were very impressionable. It didn't take too long to get to the best part of the kid because although their persona is hard, it is somewhat brittle and you can get through it if you just take the time to do that.
So you took these experiences and you decided at some point to turn this into a play, and you had a background in theater. So this was kind of a natural thing to do. But how did you decide, I'm going to, you know, how to tell the story?
Well, when I went in, it was traumatizing. So I didn't want to come home and dump it on my husband. So I came home and I would talk about what happened into a tape recorder. And it was such a traumatic situation for these kids. Now, these are girls. Again, 95% of the girls in juvenile detention have suffered from sexual assault and rape by someone they're supposed to love and trust. So I was able, because I was able to reach the kid, I was able to find the best part of each kid.
So you took these recordings and you said,
I took the recordings and I determined pretty early on that this story needed to be told. Pretty early on, because it was such a situation that nobody in the general public, nobody knows what happens to these kids, who these kids are, what has happened to them that got them there, and what happens to them once they're incarcerated. So early on, I said, this story needs to be told. So as I was making these recordings, I realized that there was a full story here. And I am a theater professional. I spent over 40 years in the theater, and I thought the best way for me to get this story out was through a play. And I was always attracted to social justice theater, Waiting for Lefty in the 30s, the Laramie Project, gay and lesbian. It's a gay and lesbian play, and The Exonerated, which is a play about people who have been incarcerated falsely.
And so who did you find to – once you had the story, where did you take it and who did you find to be the cast members?
Well, I was in Seattle at the time that I wrote it, and I was a professor of theater at Cornish College of the Arts. I was the head of the acting program there. So once the play was written the third draft of the play, I staged it in Seattle. There were other directors. I was the playwright on the project. And it had two staged readings in Seattle where I was able to rewrite the play. I would hear the play. I'd get feedback from the actors, get feedback from the audience, and then I would go and do rewrites. Then I rewrote it again, and then I brought it back and had another staged reading. And then I moved to Pittsburgh. And in 2013, I went to Washington, D.C., and there was a reading of the play in D.C. for juvenile justice experts. And I found out at that time that nothing had changed. I had gone into this prison in 1998, And in 2013, nothing had changed. So I felt at that point that I was compelled to stage the play because I really feel like this, the story of these kids needs to be told.
And you met up with Jeff Shook here at Pitt, who has been your technical advisor. And Jeff, how do you think this turned out?
I think it turned out great. I mean, I think Bonnie does a fantastic job capturing the lives, the experiences, and the realities of these young women. One of the things that I really appreciate about the play is the vast majority of young people treated as adults are boys. And even when we try to make accommodations in the adult system for boys, we're neglecting the small number but still significant number of young women in the system. And I think Bonnie's play really brings out their realities. It also – I've worked in this field for 20 years now, working with young people tried as adults. And I've done it as providing services, as an advocate, working on macro policy issues as well as research. And Bonnie's play really – It captures a lot of what I've done throughout my life, and it provides a lot of depth to the issue and really highlights some of these issues that we found in statistics that just, you know, the depth that she provides really brings them to light.
My guests have been Jeffrey Shook, Associate Professor of Social Work at the University of Pittsburgh. Professor Shook, nationally known authority on juvenile justice and an advocate for reforming the sentence of youth to adult prison. Also with us, Bonnie Cohen, author and director of the play Day Room Window, which deals with juvenile justice issues. It opens tomorrow and runs through the 25th at the New Hazlitt Theater on the North Side. Thanks to both of you for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
And thank you for listening. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, back tomorrow with another edition of Essential Pittsburgh.